I'd kind of walk out my front door and maybe know where I'm staying tonight, but carrying a tent or a bivy bag, or, you know, just having the confidence that something will always turn up in terms of accommodation gives you the confidence to just set out with no fixed agenda. And I quite like that.
Hello and thank you for joining on today's podcast. Welcome to another episode of the Distance Hiker podcast. As always, it is a blessing to have your ears on this show, and I feel so lucky that you're here today. And I wish I could reach out through your earpiece, appear in front of you and shake your hand for listening to my episode. I get a rough idea from the stats of who's listened to it, and I get the occasional message here and there, which just makes my day. You have no idea. And it makes my day because this is not about me. It's about the guest. It's about you. And I'm excited that you are listening to this. So you may have got the gist that the podcast is less about the technicalities of long distance hiking, although that may be interesting to some. To me, I'm less interested in it, although I do like a bit of kit talk, of course. And I really am turning the podcast into a more of a hiking podcast, especially in upcoming episodes, with a focus, of course, on long distance hiking, where there is more of a prerequisite for a guest to join me. But we often go off now into a lot of episodes that are recorded in the back catalogue and coming very soon of more hiking talk. And the reason behind that is because I feel that there is a lot more to life than just long distance hiking, although I still want it to be the center and the general running theme of the podcast. And I really hope that you enjoy some of the talks surrounding long distance hiking and the stories of the guests that I've got coming on, and the stories of the guests that I've shared in the past as well. The people I have on the show are the change makers in our community and the positively influential influencers, which I can't emphasize enough. I love having influencers on who feel to me like they're actually making some sort of change, which has a positive influence on our community, on the world, on the communities they strive to serve. And I've got some fantastic guests coming on soon, who are very much in that category, in my personal opinion. I also am excited that we've had custodians and have got some custodians of the trails coming on. So people who work in access, for instance, and share the stories around the difficulties and challenges and opportunities in access. And also, I love more than anything sharing a fascinating story of an individual who's not trying to promote anything or trying to share anything in particular, but who wants to share their story. And those episodes excite me because they're so raw and they're so authentic, and they are really, really nice to record. Now, my aim with the podcast is, of course, to encourage you to get out more, to walk more, to feel positive and invigorated about life. And if this is your positive listening while you're cooking dinner, or you're driving to work, or you're even at work, or you're going for a run, then I'm super happy to be in your ear today. And thank you so much again for listening. And on that note, I have a new guest for you today. Of course, I have a new guest for you. I'm going to stop talking in a minute. And I'm really happy to bring you today's guest. Today's guest is Martin Howe, who is known as Trail Planner Online. And Martin ticked all the boxes of being a fantastic guest, and he certainly did not disappoint. He has a large back catalogue of trails that he has walked, and cycling trails that he's cycled. And he obviously went into exploring those trails that he's walked and cycled. But Martin recently also wrote a book about the long distance trails, and the name of that book was Tales from the Big Trails, and it was published by Vertebrate Publishing, so it's a fully published book. And the book itself, in Martin's words, was that it's a 40-year quest to walk the iconic long distance trails of England, Scotland and Wales. So of course in the podcast we talk about the book quite a bit, especially in the second half, and also some of the challenges of getting a book published and writing it, which may well be of interest to some of you here. I know lots of people who would love to write a book, so hopefully that's of interest. We also talk about how he fits walking into his life and his career, a career which he's really managed to shape around his love for walking. It's unrelated to, but you know, he took the leap and did something different. It allows him to clear, you know, to choose that time that he wants for walking. And as with all of the guests, my talk with Martin focused on his story, his unique experiences on the trails, and how it ultimately bleeds into his everyday life. The story will feel familiar, and it involves loss and regrowth, and of course, self-discovery. Finally, back to his book, and I think Martin will take this as a compliment. Reading the book itself actually reminded me of reading a Tolkien book, you know, Lord of the Rings, for instance, or The Hobbit. Not so much for the orcs and elves, as there were none in Martin's book, but more of the way in which Martin describes the beautiful surroundings he walks through in such careful detail, and the individual he meets with, and he injects so much personality into those individuals. And that is such a gift to read a book of that stature. It's wonderful to read. So if you're in need of a new book for a holiday or some weekend reading or some bedtime reading, or, you know, or just general reading, then Martin's book is well worth your time. So a good plug of the book there. I really happy to suggest things that I feel are worth purchasing. Martin's book is certainly one of them. So without further ado, I will jump into the podcast interview now with Martin, known as Trail Planner. Enjoy the episode. Thank you. How are you doing?
Good, actually. I've just come back from Canterbury with my wife, you know, for a couple of days, and I've been taking her to some of the sites on the Kent coast, which I walked late last year. So I'm currently walking the English coast path in sections. I've got from Cromer to Chichester, and I'm just trying to see if I can find some time to continue that journey in March around the Isle of Wight and back onto the southwest coast path again, which will be quite exciting doing that in the other direction.
And were you walking at all on this particular trip away to Canterbury?
Yes, the Essex coast or the Kent coast, there's an awful lot that you miss. And the English coast path isn't really complete yet. So
no, what's missing now at the English coast path? Because it's been ongoing for quite some years, hasn't it? The sort of additions and the building of the paths and linking things up. What's left to do?
I think there's quite a bit, actually, particularly Lincolnshire and parts of Essex. There's a lot of established paths which they just need to put a few signs up. But there's a lot of sections they've still got to negotiate rights of way and things like that. Isle of Sheppey, for example, is not complete. But we did a bit of the area just south of Ramsgate and walked out onto some of the peninsulas there, which I shortcutted, to be honest, when I was walking around and just went back to have a look and get to have a look at those as well.
Sounds good. So even on a holiday with your wife, the walking continues.
Yes.
Yeah, brilliant. Good to hear. She is into it as you are, or
nowhere near as serious as I am, but she does like walking.
Yeah, brilliant. That's good. I've not finished your book. I'll admit, I'm a super slow reader, and I had a few on the go. But I'm about on my Kindle. It says I'm about 40% through, so that's pretty good going for me. What I've got to so far, genuinely can say this: I've really enjoyed it. Great book. I got a bit lost with the time scale, and that's just more me. And I noticed one of my questions was, what were you doing before you walked the Pembrokeshire Coast Path? And I realised you're about 17 when you started doing this.
Yeah, even younger.
Oh, even younger. So it was a while ago. So I've actually taken that question out of my list of questions about 10 minutes ago, because thinking that doesn't really fit. But what I did notice is that you grew up in Chichester.
Yes, I mean, yeah. I was born in Lincoln.
Okay.
My father was in the Air Force.
Yeah.
So I moved around a huge amount in my young life, and we ended up. One of his commissions was on Thorny Island, which was in Chichester Harbour. So, yes, I did go to school. I went to school in Southbourne, actually.
Oh, okay.
About 5 years before we moved somewhere else. So.
Oh, that's interesting. I only picked up on that myself because I spent. I'm younger than you, but I spent a lot of my early childhood growing up in Chichester. So we lived in South London in Surrey, but we had grandparents and a caravan in Witterings.
Yeah.
So we spent a considerable amount of time, and we used to be part of a sailing club down on the harbour as well called Del Quay. So yeah, that's. Yeah, when you mentioned that, just brought back memories and thought, it's interesting. So, so one thing led to another with a sort of outdoorsy childhood that you had, and you started this on the Pembrokeshire Coast Path. So, was that just a sort of spontaneous turnaround to your mate and go, let's go walk Pembrokeshire? Because at that time, walking long distance trails wasn't a big thing. It wasn't a known thing. Excuse me. So was there any kind of information or a pamphlet you picked up, or how did you find out about that trail?
Well, I had a partner in crime. So when we were living in Chichester Harbour, we used to, we were schoolmates, and it was quite normal on a Saturday morning for your parents to kick you out the door and not expect to see you until Sunday. And we would go camping. We would have a simple canvas tent, with the wooden poles with the a primer stove and such like, and we would just go and get lost on the islands and camp and then come back on Sunday. And then when we moved away from that, I kept in touch with my friend, and he said, why don't you come, I'm going off to Pembrokeshire, do you want to come along as well? So we put together our old backpacking gear, as it was, whatever we could scramble together. Borrowed a pair of boots from my father, which were too big, so I had to wear two or three pairs of socks. And we caught a bus out to Fishguard, and we walked, with no particular plan, but we just walked south from there. And we got as far as Dale, I think, if I remember.
So you did the vast majority of it.
It would at the time. Yeah. I mean, it was in the 70s. Yeah, so,
it was, wouldn't have been waymarked then either, would it?
And I don't know, actually. I went back and I checked several times to see whether or not I was actually only, I think I must have been 14, maybe just 15. I think I was 15, but to think I did that at that age, I think was quite amazing. I mean, it's a credit to my parents that they let me do that sort of thing, but
yeah,
I think it would, that it wasn't unheard of. But it stuck in my mind as being a very formative experience in terms of going somewhere on your own, and particularly walking in the coast with a friend, and you were you had to take care of yourself at that age. It was wonderful,
and it would have been at that time a considerably more remote area than what it is now. Obviously, there are remote sections, but it's not. Wouldn't have been half as built up as it is now. I mean, the first national trail, which was the Pennine Way, just Googled it now, was 1965. Yeah. And I can't imagine that there was sort of in the immediate years after that, other ones were established. So it definitely wasn't, a known thing. So that just struck me as being quite interesting, because I didn't quite get the timescale when I read the book, but when I kind of went back and thought about it, I understood when you actually walked that, and it just came across as pretty interesting. Yeah. Your experience on walking long distance trails has been a lifelong love of walking. So are there any trails? I'm not going to say, can you go through the list of trails you've done? You've done all of the national trails, which is a growing list, obviously. And are there points where you sort of thought you'd finished, yet another one opens?
Just continue the story from the Pembrokeshire Coast Path. Yeah. I mean, it was later on in life that I went back to Pembrokeshire with my wife, and I was I just lost my job, or I was just moving on to another job, and I had a period of time, and I said, what am I going to do with that? And I said, I told her I walked this path when I was 15. She says, why don't you do it again? So And in between that time, I mean, that was, you know, early 2000s, something like that. Mm. But in the meantime, I'd done a lot of backpacking and walking and mountaineering in Scotland, yeah, and Wales and all that sort of stuff. But I thought, yeah, let's just try that. But with no ambition to walk all the time.
How long ago was that when your wife kind of suggested to do it?
I think that's early 2000s. I'd have to go back and have a look at the actual date. So the actual period of walking all the national trails was probably about 10, 15 years, something like that.
Did you revisit Pembrokeshire then at that point?
Yes, that was the start. So let's go and revisit my childhood. I don't think if you would call it a midlife crisis or something, but the ages are about right. just go back. And I did, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Met a lot of good people. Yeah. Youth hostels were tremendous. Coastal scenery was just mind-blowing. And, the experience, I think I did it in 10 days, which was pretty good going. But that I thought, this is really good. Let's go on and do something else. And that's what the next one I did was, it's just a question of finding time, which is the most precious resource. And, decided to do the Ridgeway again, or do the Ridgeway, which I'd done sections. Yeah. And then again, it was a change of circumstances with work, but I had... This time I left work without having another job to go to with the intent of walking the Southwest Coast. So that's a much larger ambition, six weeks. And disappeared off around that, not knowing what I'm going to come back to.
Yeah, that's and how did that feel, knowing that you sort of left your work and you were doing this walk? Because I'm guessing as you're kind of at that moment, it probably feels great because the future is the walk at that point. But as you sort of continued that walk, did you have this sort of looming sense of, I've got to figure this out when I get home? Or did you figure this out now? Or did you have the feeling of, well, I can deal with this when I get home? Did it detract from that experience?
I think, going on the walk allows you to empty your mind of your previous work or whatever. Mm. And in the process of emptying your mind of those thoughts, it gives you the space for other things to come in.
And what other things came in then at that point?
Well, the thing that came in is a major decision I made about, switching from full-time work to freelance work. Hmm. And, there were several factors. I won't go into all the details. But I made the decision as I was coming back. I said, first of all, I really enjoy the walking. How can I find a different mode which allows me to continue to have the financial security through work, but also find time to do the walk? So I made a what many would consider to be the courageous decision to stand up on my own, and which in the early days was quite hard, but then it gained momentum, and I've managed to sustain a freelance career over 10-12 years now. And during that time, when I wasn't working, and particularly if I could engineer it, if I was working over winter and I had time in the summer, then I would go walking. And that's how I've found the time to do the national trails.
Mm. That's interesting, because I think that was definitely, I was aware you had at that point, before walking the South West Coast path, started to consider the option of freelance career. And I think a lot of people would kind of like to be able to be in that position where they can walk, and it does take a leap of faith. And you clearly put you found something you enjoy, which is walking these trails, and wanted it to be something which you repeatedly did. And I think it's just really, really interesting how you decided to forge a career that fits alongside that, rather than trying to squeeze it into the small cracks of annual leave that you might get otherwise.
Yeah,
I'm assuming there's no regrets to that decision then whatsoever.
No, not at all. I think in hindsight, it was a good decision.
So. Yeah, sounds it. So after you had sort of taken the leap, gone self-employed, no doubt there was a period of trying to get that work ramped up so it could be regular enough for you to then to stop and then go and walk again. Did you have a plan in your head as to what order of trails you wanted to do next at all?
Not really. I mean, a bit of an opportunist, if anything. Mm. So, if I found that I had 2 weeks, then I'd try and pick a 2 week trail. Mm-hmm. If I found I had longer, then maybe. And actually, I've strung multiple trails together as part of a single journey.
Oh, right. Which ones have you strung together?
Well, particularly in Scotland, I put the Southern Upland, the West Highland and the Great Glen together as one continuous trail. And then there's North Downs and South Downs was one continuous. So I walked from Fareham to Dover and then, you know, then from Eastbourne, you know, to Winchester on the South Downs way. So I've mixed it up, but also there's been some paths which I haven't done as a through hiker, as you would call it. But the Thames Path, for example, which is quite close to where I live, you know, that was done in any opportune days I had during a winter. So I would catch a train, walk a section, you know, catch the bus back, or sometimes leave my car at a station and take a train or something. And I worked out that the Thames Path was exactly, almost exactly 7 marathon distances in its total length. So I aimed to do 7 marathons in 7 days. And, you know, considering it's flat, I thought it might be a bit easier. But anybody who's walked the Thames Path in winter realizes it's quite hard going because of the mud. But, you know, so that path was done differently. And I'm an opportunist in terms of, you know, have I got the time? How am I going to do it? You know, what am I going to camp? What time of year it is, and so on. You know, really guides which path I choose next.
And did you know that you wanted to walk the national trails and the sort of more established trails in particular? And did you, I guess, expanding that somewhat? Did you know that sort of you wanted to? Yeah, go with that. Did you know that you wanted to walk those particular trails or whatever?
No, I don't.
In your line of sight?
I think I didn't set out with an ambition or a tick list to do all 19. I joined the Long Distance Walkers Association and they love lists. Yeah, they've got lists.
For which you're a part of an elite group of individuals who's walked, 50 of you who's walked over all the trails, is that right?
Yeah, well, 50 that's recorded.
50 that's recorded,
Who are into lists, that you could say. But yeah, there's lots, they've got lists for everything. And that was only when I came across that they had a National Trail Register. And it was only after I published the book that I realised the term National Trail gets quite complicated.
In what sense?
Well, in the sense that if you speak to Natural England, capital N National, capital T Trail is the ones they manage with the acorn symbol, which is Natural England also do Wales, which, you know. But in Scotland, the four pre-devolution, there were 4 national trails in Scotland, which were the West Highland, Southern Upland, Great Glen and Speyside Way. But they're not national trails governed by Natural England anymore. They're governed under a different system. But
I see.
To get sort of technical, I guess my definition of them was anything that had central government funding, which all those 19 do.
Yes.
And the Long Distance Walkers Association sort of hold a similar view for that. But that's getting pedantic about lists. But yeah, I saw the list and I was already into it. And I thought, well, let's just keep going. Yeah, this is rather than choosing, say, the coast to coast or something like that to go and walk. Let's just work my way through the list and see how far we go.
And was there a reason that you perhaps chose to predominantly stick to UK, European and Scandinavian trails and cycle routes, moving on to that a little bit, over sort of, you know, packing your bags and this being off to New Zealand and walking or America and walking some trails further afield? Was there a draw to this landscape?
Well, I have done some trails in the States. I've got friends in the States. And when I go over there, particularly when I've worked on business historically, I would always try and sneak a week and do something. Uh-huh. And also, I was very fortunate to have worked in New Zealand for a while.
Some
trails.
Oh, right. Wasn't aware of that.
But no, I think the UK has so much to offer. I think, you know, it's surprising how diverse, you know, the landscapes are and how interesting that culturally is, depending on where you are in the UK. And I found that was plenty. That was enough for me. And, I'm still drawn to that. Because I mentioned earlier, my father was in the Air Force, so I'd spent a lot of time abroad already And I've spent 6 or 7 years living in Singapore, for example, as part of, you know, as a young child, but also as an adult in later life. So I'd already done a lot of traveling, and I find just what is on offer in this country is as good as anywhere else. So I don't see any need to go. Whereas with cycling, where you can cover more distances, then certainly, you know, Europe is more accessible, and because the cycle network in Europe is quite a bit better than the UK, although the UK is surprisingly good, you know, that allows you to travel a bit further. And I think in terms of long range, if I was thinking of doing something, then it would certainly be a switch to cycling rather than walking.
Okay. And are you limited then in, obviously you've got your freelance work going on, which pays for your trail tokens, as the saying goes, but are you limited in terms of time that you have for these things? So say if you want to, you kind of thought, you know what, next year I'm going to walk, you know, the PCP trail in America, would you have the option to do that? Have you got that luxury to be able to do those?
No, I think there would be other constraints. Yeah, first of all, being homesick. I think my wife might draw a line at that point.
Yeah. So how do you negotiate with your wife then? Because that surely is the biggest challenge, is terms of negotiating with family commitments. You know, if you've got kids, trying to take time out for those. So how did you first approach? I mean,
the kids have got a bit older, so they're kind of left home. And my wife has been very supportive. I'm very lucky in that sense. And also there's an implicit promise that, yeah, when I've done a trail, that I come back and I take her back within a year or something to see the best bits.
Oh, okay. And, that's a really nice idea, actually.
If there's a little cafe that's hidden, that's unknown, not particularly popular, but, you know, then I'll take her there. Or there's a particular section of beach or a particular, you know, sort of section of walk, and I take her back to those bits.
And have you fulfilled that promise every time then, so far?
Not every time, no. but in general, yes.
Of course. Yeah, I mean, what I liked about the book of yours is that it is full of those, and without you really trying to push it, but through your experience, it's full of little tidbits and places to stay and go and see and do and the people you met. Was there anybody, this is probably a very broad question, but was there anything, any particular person or group of experiences that jumped out of you throughout the whole of that period in terms of acts of human kindness or anything like that?
Oh, there's just so many, really. And they continue to astonish me. What I find is that sometimes, you know, your very worst day on the trail can suddenly turn into your very best day. So, you know, I just talk generally, you know, but this type of thing has happened, that where I've been walking all day and I'm soaked to the skin, and I get to a campsite and, you know, a walk in, and I think people know what you're doing. You know, they know you're a long distance walker. They know that you've just spent the day. And I've had offers that, why don't you come back? You know, we've got a space at the dinner table and you can stay, we've got a spare room, and they just offer. And I'm very, you know, sort of too embarrassed really to accept at times, but that's happened a few times, and I find that very good, powerful, actually, because you have very good conversations with those individuals. They want to hear about what it is you're doing. And I want to hear about the area that they live in as well. So, yeah, they're very, you know, enjoyable. And but a lot of the trails, I because you travel on your own, you're much more, you know, people approach you much more readily than they would if you were a couple or a group.
Yeah.
And therefore I'm making a lot of connections, and that's part of the enjoyment of walking.
And I think the having the backpack on as well definitely draws a sense of attention to you beyond the,
yeah, you know, funny tan lines. Yeah,
exactly. Smelling a bit funky. Yeah, definitely draws some attention. So what is it, what are the things that draw you to this? And that includes cycling as well, this sort of person-powered long-distance adventure. What do you personally feel you get out of it that makes you want to do it again and again and again?
Well, I just find it so joyful. Yeah, at times, you know, being in the hills or on the coast, on your own. It's a cliche, but saying it, you're coming back to nature, but you were able to not tune into nature, but you become more observant. The more that you walk, the more you see, the more you see, you know, the more you understand. And I think it's just my curiosity, really. I'm very curious about, you know, what I'm going to find. And so the thing that I enjoy more than anything is that starting a walk without having an expectation of what it's going to be like. I mean, I've got some rough idea, but I'm not one who really likes planning every single day for 2 weeks. You know, I prefer to just kind of walk out my front door and maybe know where I'm staying tonight, but carrying a tent or a bivy bag or, you know, just having the confidence that something will always turn up in terms of accommodation gives you the confidence to just set out with no fixed agenda. And I quite like that. And there's also a relationship between, you know, the book, in that walking is a narrative, you know, it's a journey, isn't it? And the book writing is the same, it's the same sort of instrument that you use. Mm. And the way in which you empty your mind and you fill it up with other stuff and just let your thoughts, you know, drift as you walk, is very, very pleasurable. And I found it, you know, actually in my freelance work, when I've been on a long walk and I come back and I go into the corporate environment, you know, I'm getting on the train and going up this big glass tower in London somewhere and sitting down at a table, and you get into a meeting and I'm petrified that I can't remember anything, but a little switch goes on and my business brain re-engages, but I'm much more relaxed, more empathetic with the people around the table, and that and also, you know, I think that that's improved my performance, let's say, in the work environment. Maybe it's I'm just rested, I'm not stressful. So the two benefit each other.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really nice answer, actually, beyond the generic answers I hear. So that's lovely. So the book, I want to talk about that briefly. So this is a am I allowed to use the word memoir? I don't really know if that's fair of it, but
have you
it felt like a memoir, sort of a diary of your experiences on trails. What did you have a diary from when you were walking that you were able to refer back to for all of these trails, or was this written through memory of those experiences? A lot of experience to go through and sort of put down on paper and condense.
Yes, I mean, there's the photographs is one thing, but which of various quality. From the early days of carrying candy bar phones and taking 1 megapixel pictures to what all the technology you have today. But I always kept a diary and or just scribbled some notes. And in the Southwest Coast Path, what I did is every day I bought a postcard and I wrote the previous day's experience down on it.
I read that. I posted it
to my wife. And so when I came home, I had a big stack of postcards and I kept those. I've got everything from scraps of paper to lovely moleskin notebooks to, you know, but they I had written notes, contemporaneous notes, if you call it that, for all of the routes. And, you know, they did form the basis of the book, combined with, you know, the photographs. But what I really found interesting was that I was able to recall my walking journeys far more clearly than any other type of holiday. So if you'd asked me to recall a holiday I spent in, say, Spain for 2 weeks, I could, you know, I couldn't tell you what I drank, couldn't tell you what I eat, couldn't tell you what I can't remember it. But I can remember all of these walks, you know, even with just a small trigger to the memory, I can then unearth detail. And I think it's something to do with the pace at which you walk, allows you to absorb the experience more fully and process it into your long-term memory more effectively than any other form of, you know, sort of travel. Cycling doesn't do it in the same way, but walking definitely, you retain a lot of the experience of walking.
Okay. And So I'm going to move on to move off from the book for a second. So I want to go on to the cycling aspects of this.
Yes.
So you branched out from walking trails to cycling. Now, at what point of the journey did you do that? Was that sort of after you'd sort of walked all the trails, you start cycling, or was that in between walking trails, you start cycling, and what drew you to that?
No, there was, it was in between, really. I think it was another piece of work that finished, and I thought, Land's End's John O'Groats. This is midlife crisis coming back again, isn't it? But let's
do
that.
How old were you when you did the Land's End John O'Groats?
Oh, now you're asking. I think that was 2001.
Okay. Yeah.
So that's 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And I mean, as a backpacker, you've got all the gear. You've got the tent, sleeping bag, and all that sort of stuff.
And was that a solo journey when you did that?
It was a solo journey.
Yeah.
It was more than Land's End John O'Groats because I did the four cardinal points. So Lizard to Lowestoft to Ardnamurchan to Dunnet Head and then back again.
Yeah.
And so I did that. I think that took a couple of weeks. And it's very similar in the backpacking, the outdoor experience, and just picking quiet lanes, not particularly using the Sustrans network, but just taking out an ordnance survey map, particularly the tour series, which if you the one to 250,000, you can actually pick out quite good cross country routes, and then doing it, but those cardinal points, going across the Pennine, it was fairly easy.
Yeah, you don't need quite a big, tight map, do you, for long distance?
No, you don't. No. So, and then that, I don't know where I. Yes, I think when I was walking the Pennine Bridleway, which I walked north to south, the last section as you come into Matlock.
Yeah,
was just a constant cycle path. It was 20 miles of cycle path, and i.e. flat, lovely surface, gravelled, and it was boring to walk it. And I thought, right, next journey I'm going to do is on a bike, and I went out and I bought a Thorn Sherpa, which is one of these steel framed rugged
things. Proper touring bikes.
That it's like a tank, really. Yeah. Well, not like a tank. It's actually a beautiful bike because it really holds weight well.
Yeah.
It's not particularly fast.
Yeah. But cycle touring bikes are lovely machines, aren't they? I think they're often far better built than a lot of carbon fiber racers, in my opinion.
So I took that and, my first bike was just on a rickety old something with, panniers just thrown over a rack. But the Thorn was more, sort of purposeful in that. And then I also started trying to keep as much of it off-road by following either Sustrans routes, particularly off. So if you take the Sustrans National Cycle Network Route 1, which goes from Dover to Shetland, if you go along that, first of all, it's all really quite quiet roads, but also there's a lot of off-road railway tracks and canal towpaths and such like. It's really very good. So when I was in, where was it now? Yeah, it was on the Cleveland Way in Ravenscar. I sat down as I was walking the Cleveland Way and just eating my sandwiches. And I noticed that written on the bench I was sitting on was the North Sea Cycle Route.
That's where that idea came.
Oh, I wonder what that is. And when I got home, I looked it up and I thought, wow, that's crazy. Yeah, that's 6,000 kilometers. And I thought, yeah, that sounds great. So, again, setting off with no particular understanding of whether or not I'd complete it in one go, which I didn't. I did it in two.
So how long after you got back did you then go on and do that cycle route?
Yeah, maybe within a year. I'm just guessing because I can't recall exactly.
Also, just rough time scales.
Then I set out from London and just followed what is Eurovelo 12.
Okay.
Also, National Cycle Route 1, I picked it up in London and then just followed it all the way up to Shetland, the very far north that you can go in the British Isles, a place called Skaw Bay.
Yeah.
And during that journey, I lost my younger brother to cancer.
Yes,
so that was, and I was going to fly from Shetland to Bergen, but you know, had to come back down for the funeral, ended up flying from Heathrow out to Bergen, and then completed the route around the south of Norway from Bergen down through, coming almost up to Oslo, crossing to Sweden, down through Sweden, crossing to Denmark, up over the top to Skagen, which is right at the tip, and then coming all the way back down through Germany, the Netherlands, and so on, and crossing the Channel into London and back home.
And if you don't mind me asking a sensitive question, do I have to answer this? In terms of you losing your brother at the same time as doing that, did that, that being a coincidence, but did the experience of cycling and being on, you know, on the trail help with that loss at all?
Yeah, it undoubtedly did, yes. Mm. I mean, you know, just exercising, be it walking, it definitely helps you to process grief.
Yeah.
Something, I mean, I'd lost my brother during that, but I'd also lost both my parents in short succession during the period of these walks. And I've also lost two really good friends of mine for various, you know, without going into detail, yeah. but people who were my age who maybe lost their lives too young. And maybe I was sort of talking about a midlife crisis earlier where, you know, wanted to try and get something done before I get old and knackered. But, you know, the certainly being close to and having to go to too many funerals, you know, it does make you think a little bit harder. So I do value the time of walking and cycling much more, recognizing that it's time that is the most valuable asset, not necessarily, you know, material. So during this period, I've also made a very conscious decision to, live with less. You know, I realize in a corporate environment, you know, company car and all that sort of stuff, actually, when you come out of the corporate environment, you don't need the car anymore. Also, you don't need this anymore.
Live with less.
Yeah. And walking and cycling and, you know, touring is the embodiment of that, because you are, you know, you've just got a tent, a sleeping bag, and a few other things, and a backpack and a pair of boots. Yeah. And it's relatively, well, it is inexpensive.
Yeah. The more you carry, the more it hurts.
Yeah. Well, and cycling helps in that regard, because cycling's even cheaper, because you can really be self-sufficient in terms of cooking. And you can be much more comfortable in terms of camping, because you can carry, you know, just those extra kilos, which make the difference.
And when you do these, you say you don't have a plan as such. Is that the same for cycling as well? You just sort of go and see where you can find accommodation or where there's a suitable place to camp?
Not in terms of day by day.
Yeah.
Because conditions can change. Yeah, the weather can change. That's why I don't try to lay out exactly what I'm doing over a week.
Yeah.
But I try to you know, at least have a day or 2 days ahead. Okay. And I think that actually the more experienced that I've become, the more complacent I become. So I thought, oh, don't worry, I'll find some. And I have been caught out, you know, particularly in the later journeys by being complacent and actually having to rough camp. Yeah, sort of at the last moment, where a bit of planning, particularly with the pandemic, I found that trying to find campsites or accommodation has been particularly difficult, either through demand or the fact that they're not open, or there's changing circumstances, which means that the spontaneity that I enjoyed in the early days, if I can say that, it's not as easy to find that spontaneity now. I'm walking the English coast path at the moment, and it's much more difficult to plan, but that's also a factor of the fact that I'm walking through urban areas.
Yeah. And also, I'm assuming you take a smartphone when you walk as well.
Of course.
So obviously that is helpful in many regards to, well, it's the weather's looking bad tomorrow, or, you know, on Thursday, I could book somewhere and stay somewhere warm and dry. And then you can look ahead at that, can't you? Whereas, you know, when you started in 2001, that was not an option. You had to
it really was. You know, compass and map.
Yes.
And
has that diminished from the experience, do you think, at all?
Sorry?
Has that diminished the experience at all, do you reckon? Or has it added more in terms of reassurance and ability to plan ahead than it's taken away in terms of
spontaneity? No, that's a good question. I think that you can, you know, more information is leading to better decisions. Yes. Mm. So be that the weather forecast or the knowledge that you do have a place to stay at the end of a walk means that you might walk a bit further. Yes, I think it does help, quite apart from the fact that smartphone is, I mean, we could probably spend 15 minutes listing all the things it can do.
Oh, yeah.
apart from photographs and music, you know, recording and et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, that facility has certainly made things a lot easier. But also there's a part to it where talking about, you know, the sort of certain serendipity or the certain, you know, spontaneity about the walk is that you know what you're going to come across. And particularly with things like Instagram, which I don't use. So when I do take a smartphone, I don't have any social media on it at all, just the internet and email.
Is that something you delete off before you go or just something?
Yeah, well, I generally keep it off
anyway.
So I sort of have
self-control.
Yeah, sort of policy, which is I only interact with social media through a desktop computer. And you know, when you come across places like when I was walking recently around Kent and came into Dover, there were crowds of people, you know, Instagramming the White Cliffs of Dover, and you know, it would have been, if I'd done that 20 years ago, probably had the whole cliffs to myself. So and that does skew the patterns of, you know, supply and demand in terms of accommodation and restaurants and cafes and all that sort of stuff. So it's that's been a noticeable. So the technology is a good thing, but in some ways it's also a bad thing, I think, in some way.
Okay, cool. I'm glad I asked that. Following on from that theme in terms of you know, before and after smartphones, how have you seen interested in this because you have been doing this for a little while. So how have you seen trails change, in particular both their, you know, the actual trail itself in terms of how it's maintained and signposted, but also those who interact with them, walk them, the busyness of them? Have you noticed a difference between now and 2001?
I don't think there's been too much of a change, no. Maybe with accommodation, youth hostels, you know, I think are not as good as they were, because I really enjoy a youth hostel because you get like-minded people.
Yeah.
But I think as soon as you get out of the towns and the cities or the villages and you get into the remote, particularly if you wake up early, and which I tend to do, and I don't tend to walk in terms of distance. I tend to walk in terms of time. So how long is it going to take me to get somewhere? But the spontaneity certainly of, you know, last minute accommodation is not so easy now. But I don't think there's any change in the, you know, the people I meet and the interactions that I have. And certainly the landscape is as beautiful as it always has been.
Okay. You don't find that you're not finding the trails are busier at this, at these days, or is it, I guess it's probably hard to tell because in those remote sections anyway, it's, you know, you can't really compare numbers.
It depends on what time of year that you walk. I mean, I certainly...
Do you try to avoid those times of years where, you know...
Yeah, you wouldn't catch me walking around the Southwest Coast Path in July and August. I think that's madness.
Yeah.
And there'd be certain times of year when I wouldn't walk in Scotland.
You know, for the midges.
Because of the weather conditions and the midges and the ticks. Yeah. The ticks, I think, more so than the midges nowadays. So I do pick my time as to when I'm doing this. And that's what's making the English Coast Path a bit more challenging because I don't have the luxury of that. But I'm trying to keep outside of you know, school holiday periods and what have you. But the pandemic has certainly made staycationing, as I think everybody appreciates, you know, a lot of people taking their breaks in the country means that accommodation's, you know, completely booked out as soon as the sun comes out.
Yeah, and I think that trend's going to continue for a couple of years yet, to be honest. I think.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
A lot of people have wised up, and in many ways it's nice to see, more ways than not, it's nice to see that people are enjoying, you know, the country that they live in rather than feeling the need to jet off somewhere else to escape it, because there's some, you know, amazing places to visit, as you know. So, right, brain fart aside, I've gone back to the question which I had. So your book, I wanted to ask very simple questions. I don't know why it evaded me. What made you want to write this book? And at what point did you think, I want to turn my experience into a book for others to read?
Well, I can't remember what path it was, but I was walking with this young woman who we were going through books that we'd read that related to walking.
Okay.
And she was into, she was a long distance walker, and we mentioned, you know, Turn Right at Land's End, which is the famous book from John Merrill, one of the first people to walk around the coast of Britain. And we were just going through the list, and I said, well, I really enjoy reading, and she did too. And I, and then she said, you should try writing. It's an intense form of reading.
Okay.
So if you think of a television as being sort of a passive,
yes,
you know, you don't really absorb anything. Reading, you're absorbing a bit more.
Yeah.
But try writing, and it's even more intense. So, you know, I thought, okay, let's have a go at this. And
have you done any writing?
No, nothing.
No, nothing at all. So first-time author.
I'd failed English at school.
Oh, so, okay.
I'm a bit of a right hemisphere person. So there was two challenges. First of all, get the left hemisphere going a bit.
Yeah.
And then secondly, you know, actually secretly, you know, with my one of my friends, we made a New Year's resolution in the millennium to write a book before we... Yeah, it was one of a life ambition.
Yeah.
Well, he did, but I didn't.
Hmm.
I'm not competitive or anything, but I thought, no, these sorts of things coming together, and I've got the notes, so I thought, no, let's just write a chapter. So I wrote a chapter and I sent it. I've got a few friends who are copywriters and you know a bit about this and did pass their English O-levels, and some of them have got degrees in A-levels and everything, and they gave me some advice. And I incorporated that advice, worked on it, got four chapters together, sent it out to a few more people, starting to get positive. I think I'm starting to find my voice and writing it down. And then that became 19, which was like an enhanced form of all the notes that I've made. You know, it was, you know, you said a memoir, and it's the first time anybody's ever said that to me, but in some ways it was a memoir. And I thought, no, let's try this. This is okay. And I put it down for a while, and then I came back to it. I think it was about a 4-year period from when I wrote the first word to it being finished. I put it down for a bit, came back. I had some time over winter, couldn't get a job. And I put a lot of effort into integrating it and making it read a lot better and doing a bit more research and adding a bit more material to it. And then I started looking for a publisher. And I've got no experience of this whatsoever.
This is the challenging bit, isn't it? Did you know that you wanted to go down the publisher route as opposed to perhaps self-publishing, which is an option these days for a lot?
I was aware of self-publishing, so and I was aware, and also with the publisher it was a question, you know, do you find an agent or not? And I didn't know the answers to these questions, and there's a lot of opinions out there.
An agent who would go and take the book on your behalf to publishers and pitch for
yes you. Okay. But yeah, I think that the, you know, the what I'd heard was the most important thing to get your book published is to be a published author. So once you're in, sort of thing. But no, I kept with it, and I got it into a state where I thought, no, this is ready, and it's in sufficient, you know, it's edited to a sufficient quality that I could self-publish it. And I went to, you know, Kindle, and it's KDP, Kindle Direct Publishing, and saw that that was all fairly straightforward. Commissioned somebody to do a cover for me for, you know, 50 quid or something like that. And I was just about to sign with that individual to get the cover done, and I got an email from Vertebra, and they said, we've read your book and we want to publish it. and it was fantastic.
That different? That was different to the Kindle publisher you were looking at, or?
Yeah, no, Kindle is online, publishing.
Oh, I see. Oh, got you. Right, I'm with you.
Okay. Vertebra is, publish a great deal of mountaineering and running and walking. Yeah. They're probably one of the best known in the UK.
They are, yeah. They sort of do all the guides, don't they, for, climbing and walking.
Yes, and they've done a lot of guides, but they didn't have many narratives. So they picked this up and... I had applied a year earlier to them, but nobody picked it up. And I, it's be prepared for rejection when you start sending manuscripts out. And actually, not just be prepared for a rejection, be prepared for no answer whatsoever. Mm. So,
did you have to really go through a series of publishers then before you got to?
Yes, I think there's the writer's guide. There's a big pink red book that you can buy, and I went through that every page trying to identify outdoor writer things, and only got to about 10. Mm. So I just wrote all of them and went on the websites and sort of submitted documents. But what Vertebrate said, it was quite unusual to get a completely finished manuscript.
I was going to say, everything was finished. Must be because often they get a pitch, don't they, and a few chapters, and then there's the advance to go and write the rest of the book, which is essentially a form of payment to write the book.
Yes.
Really. So you presented them mostly finished. Yeah, on future work. Yeah, you presented the mostly finished book to them. So from the point then of presenting that book, I'm asking this because I'm just genuinely interested in this kind of thing. From the point of presenting that book, how long did it take for you to sort of have to go back and make the changes to getting it,
Well, once they said they wanted to publish, assigned a contract, and then, which is fairly straightforward, and then it went through editing process, which was really good. I worked with some fantastic editors who were walkers and outdoor people, and would pick up the really good and hot on details. So I misdescribed the aircraft which carries the big wings, for Airbus that comes out of North Wales. I misdescribed that. And they said, no, it's not called a super guppy, it's called a something or other. I can't
remember. Oh, really? Thorough then.
Correction was. But they picked up on that. Hmm. And they went through that and then getting a cover done and a few more elements of design and a bit about the author, what they call the blurb, which is a description of the book and all the preparation materials. Mm-hmm. And then they actually launch the book before it's actually published and it becomes available for pre-order and it goes onto Amazon and through their distribution channels and what have you. So that took, about 4 or 5 months, something like that. And then it came out September 2021, last year.
Wow. And since when it came out, what's been involved in terms of marketing it?
Well, I think if you want to write a book, I think a third of the effort is writing it. I think a third of the effort is finding somebody to publish it.
Yeah.
Now, I think there's another third of the effort, if not two-thirds of actually marketing it. Yeah. And I think I had the expectation that the publisher would do all this for you, but no, you're expected to do quite a bit.
Do they sort of point you in the right direction in terms of, oh, you should go to this bookshop and do a speech here and,
Well, I've done a couple of launches at a couple of bookshops, which have been really good. And, for me, first of all, it's not been about the money. It's, you mentioned memoir, but it was actually becoming a published author, I think, is an achievement on its own.
Oh, yeah, massively.
And the second thing that I really visualized was I would love to give a talk at Stanford's in London.
I was going to say, that's the bit that caught me, and I was going to get to that. How was that? Because that for many people is a lifelong dream to talk at a bookshop like Stanford's. It's such a well-regarded travel bookshop and beautiful at that.
So I've been going there 30, 40 years. Oh, yeah, okay. Every time I go up to London.
Yeah.
I always go back through Covent Garden before I go home and I go into Stanford's and I just browse around and see what I can find. I always buy something and, they've now moved, to a larger place, but it doesn't have the same, sort of patina as the old place had, but nevertheless, it's still great. So Yeah, I mean, just having a book published there. And actually, I walked in the other day and it was on their favourite read section. Oh, wonderful. You know, sitting next to people who, you know, way, you know, in the stratosphere compared to, you know, sort of what I'm doing, you know, like walking Himalayan mountains and what have you. So, but it was good. And it was good giving the talk. And part of the thing that's been really good about writing the book is it's introducing me to lots of new people.
Yeah.
You know, you're an example of that. Mm. And, but also it's introducing me to the artistic community. It's introducing to me people who've got a passion about walking and more the philosophy of walking and the, you know, the mental health benefits and all this and everything. And it's opening my mind and it's introducing me to a new community of people, which is quite different from, you know, my work life.
Mm. I mean, but this must have been a community that you've kind of been involved with before that anyway, through walking. Or is it that you've never really been involved in it in terms of a online email, doing things like this, where you've just sort of been involved in it only when you're walking?
Yeah, I mean, during the walks, I would have met a few acquaintances and maybe kept in touch with a few people and been aware of people. But the writing community, I've joined, you know, a bit more active in the Long Distance Walkers Association, and I've been, having dialogue with them, and they've got plans to start new registers and what have you. And you can talk for ages pedantically about the length of this and the length of that. But also, quite recently, something I should have put down as a question really for this session is that I'm getting involved with a charity at the moment who did a walk around the Suffolk and Essex coast. But it was an art project, and they manufacture these silk flags, and they get members of the community to come up with a design for the flags, and then they print the flag for them, and then they carry the flag along the length of the coast. And they did this. It was featured in The Guardian, and it's called The Beach of Dreams.
Beach of Dreams, isn't it?
And I sort of was quite inspired by this, what they were doing. So I thought, I'm in London, they're launching their film. So I went along to the film, and it was great, and I met some people. Then they sort of casually announced that they want to do this for the whole of the British Isles. Oh, wow. And, you know, to walk the whole of the British Isles in May 2024. I mean, I don't think this is a formally launched thing.
Is this sort of like a relay then, as such? With these?
It's not a relay. It's probably 40 to 50 teams walking them in parallel.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Oh.
So I stuck my hand up. Yeah. Fortunately or unfortunately, and offered to help. So I'm actually getting involved in helping them plan that and doing the feasibility around that the moment. So, but I've spoken to other people like yourself who are from this sort of artistic community. And one of the things about walking is that you come across so much art or poetry or, you know, and I'm very interested in that. And I stop to read it, and it's, you know, poems can be very powerful. You know, you've got something to think about as you continue to walk, and then you really begin to understand it. Yeah. And I think, oh, that's interesting. So when you get to the end of the book, there's quite a bit about, you know, what I find in Norfolk and the song lines, the Norfolk song lines. And I just got really interested with that. And, you know, sort of, so that's another part, which is develop my left hemisphere, so to speak.
And so your art, your craft is obviously now writing. Are you hoping to do more of this into the future? Have you got any other plans to do any more writing?
Yeah, I'd like to write about the cycling.
Yeah, in a similar kind of fashion to what you've done with this book.
Yeah, I'd sort of made a start, but I haven't found the groove yet. But I've done the North Sea Cycle Route, which is Eurovelo 12. And then I've also cycled Land's End to John O'Groats again, but following the Atlantic seaboard as closely as possible, including going across to Ireland. So Land's End to the Severn Bridge, south coast of Wales, across to Rosslare and Ireland, down the south coast of Ireland, up the Wild Atlantic Way, which is a designated tourist route, really, but not perfect for cycling, but doable. And then when I got through to Donegal and then to Derry and then into Northern Ireland, to Ballycastle, you can get a high-speed ferry that takes you across to Islay.
Okay.
And then Islay to Mullaghcantyre up to Oban and then across out to the Outer Hebrides and then back across to Ullapool and up and round all the way to John O'Groats. I think it was about 4,000 kilometres. That was really good. That was a really good cycle journey.
Well, so undoubtedly book number two is going to be full of as many stories.
Yeah, but it's all coastal. It's all coastal. Yeah.
But there's a lot of, there's so much culture on the coast as well that, you know, and I, in fact, I think I enjoyed the sections, the coastal sections of your book more than the, you know, the inland sections. I think because the, I think for me, like you, I guess, growing up on the coast always brings back that memory of kind of fresh open skies, clear head. So coastal walking is definitely exciting. I think there's a reason why authors like, you know, Rainer Wynn, for instance, have, you know, created best-selling books because there's something about the coast on the side.
Yeah, maybe that. So there's either the cycle coastal, which is those two journeys, plus some other journeys. So I've island hopped in the Southern Hebrides as well on a bike.
Yeah.
You know, using Calmac ferries.
Yeah.
But I've walked the Welsh Coast Path since the National Trails as well. Yeah. I did that 2019, which is 870. Yeah, so that's it deserves the title of a national trail. It's fantastic. Yeah.
Well, it's very well waymarked as well, isn't it, the Welsh?
Yes, it's perfect. Yeah. And it's quite a good community. And I met a few people who were supporting and developing that for Natural Wales, or the equivalent Welsh government organization. And then I'm walking the English coast at the moment, so we've got from Cromer to Chichester, which triggered your thought. You'd be interested to know, when I went into the cathedral at Chichester, they had a nine meter illuminated lunar moon the middle of the cathedral.
Oh, wonderful.
It's an art installation that's been touring the country.
Oh, amazing.
And, yeah, I'm hoping to continue that. Actually, in the next couple of weeks, I'm planning to go around the southwest coast again, around the Isle of Wight, around down the southwest coast.
You're going to go back along the coastal path again, southwest coast path?
Yeah, I think walking it in the other direction will be quite a different experience, actually.
I guess it would, wouldn't it? Yeah, I guess it would.
I don't know. It's going to be interesting. It's 15 years since I've done it.
It's so would have, yeah, interesting, I guess, to see what's changed as well in that time.
Yeah, exactly.
Wonderful. One more question from me. After you've what's the next big trail you want to do? What's the next really big challenge you're going to go for? Or is it English Coast Path after that? Is it just a continuation of just trying to get in as many long distance trails as appeal to you as you possibly can?
I think if I was to think of books, or sort of major groupings, then it would one would be
That's I guess what I'm trying to point towards.
Yeah, the national trails.
Yeah.
The next one is the coastal cycling.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of that. There's the next concept for a book would be having walked the Welsh Coast Path and the English Coast Path. I'd like to do the Scottish National Trail, except do it from Lindisfarne to Cape Wrath.
Okay.
So, and that's the path which is visualised by Cameron McNeish, who's sort of, he's done a couple of television programmes about it. And it is waymarked at the beginning and the end, not much in the middle. But that's because it puts together, Cape Wrath Trail, Rob Roy Trail, John Muir Trail, St Cuthbert's Way. It puts together existing trails into links. But that's a sort of a serious backpacking 5 week, six week expedition.
It'd be very, very remote, I'm guessing, as well. That.
Yeah, I think in the northwest of Scotland. I mean, I have done backpacking in that area before, so it doesn't prevent him, but you're getting to the hard bits at the end of the walk, and you need to be in a reasonably good fit condition. So I think I don't have a problem with fitness. I have a problem with injury, really.
Okay.
Yeah, if you do get injured, as you get older, you don't recover as quickly as you do when you're younger. But fitness wise, I'm still sort of knocking out 20-25 mile days. So
pretty good going.
Yeah,
amazing. All right, well, brilliant. I think that's excuse me, that's everything from me. So yeah, it's been lovely to talk to you today.
Yeah.
About the book. So thank you for coming on. For those listening, where is the best place to find you online to learn more about what you do in the book?
Well, for the book, it's Vertebrate. Yeah, it'd be lovely if people bought the book from Vertebrate because it supports that independent publisher.
Yeah.
I also run a blog. I mean, it's not a commercial by any means. It's a hobby, which is called Trail Planner.
Yeah.
Trailplanner.co.uk, and well, from there you can contact me. You can get links to, you know, sort of other feeds as well. I can't remember all the addresses, but yeah, if you go to Trail Planner, that has got information about, you know, the kit that I carry, the cycle journeys I've done, the walking I've done, the walking planning I do. Many blog, yeah, I've been running that for almost 8 years.
Yeah.
And it also includes some camper van stuff I do as well. So I've also got a motorbike, which I'd like to do some touring on as well. So yeah, and you can tell there's a theme here of freedom and yes, travel and adventure. Yeah. So the camper van I've had for 20 odd years. It's a bit tatty now, but it's been everywhere. It's been quite a few places in Europe, but in the UK, and to use that, particularly journeys in Scotland, and to Orkney and to the Hebrides and to Shetland, using the camper van, and yeah, a mixture of that and cycling. So yeah, that's been going for a while. It's just a, you know, sort of a hobby, and it's ticking along quite nicely.
Wonderful. Yeah, just looking at it now, it's a pretty comprehensive website full of lots and lots of stories. So
yeah,
good bit of reading. Well, brilliant. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Okay,
best of luck with everything in the future. It's been massive.
Yeah.
Thank you again for listening to this episode of the podcast. Did you enjoy it? Did you get something out of it? I'd love to know what you thought of the show. Seriously, drop me a message and let me know. You can email me at matthew@distancehiker.com or contact me on Instagram or Facebook. Or better still, drop me a message and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or a rating on Spotify. It all helps to grow the podcast and allows me to meet a bigger audience and share the trail magic with everybody who listens. So that concludes today's show. But before I go, I just wanted to let you know about our long distance hiking community. You may have come across in the community, at which point you may not be too interested in this notification, but if you have not come across from the community and found me through Instagram or just found me on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you found me, I guess, then you may want to know about this community. Distance Hiker and the Distance Hiker podcast and everything I do centers around a wonderful community of around 12,000 individuals who all share a love for one thing, which is long distance trails and hiking. The community has been running for a couple of years now and is absolutely jam-packed full of posts, helpful information, photos and stories of from the members, and you know, loads of questions as well. So there's tons of questions that you may have which have probably been answered in the group already. So I'd love to have you in the group if you want to join. And to find the group, you simply go to Facebook and, or was that Meta? No, it's still Facebook, isn't it? And search for UK long distance hiking. There's UK long distance hiking, and you should find the group come up with a big banner on the top saying UK long distance hiking. Just request to join and I'll let you in. So thanks again for listening to the show, and I look forward to having you join me again next week. Goodbye for now.